Welcome back to the deep dive. We're doing something a little different today.
Yeah, getting a bit more grounded.
Exactly. Usually we tackle these really big abstract concepts, you know, trends in tech or shifts in the broader economy. But today we are zooming all the way in.
All the way down to the metal boxes.
Right. We are looking at a specific, very tangible nightmare that basically anyone who manages a facility or is building out a serious workshop has faced at some point. We are talking about electrical power distribution.
And I know to some people that sounds a little dry.
It does sound dry.
It does. But honestly, if you have ever stood there in front of a contractor and you're trying to explain what you need, and you suddenly realize you don't actually know the words for the thing you were pointing at.
Oh, man.
That is a very special kind of panic.
It is. And that is exactly where our source material starts today. We are looking at this fantastic account from a DIY enthusiast. Let's just call him Dave. So Dave is upgrading this light industrial workshop, and he's confident. You know, he's done all the math. He figures the hard part is going to be the physical labor.
Bending the rigid conduit, pulling that heavy 500 MCM wire.
Sweating through his shirt, exactly. The sweat equity phase.
Right.
But he was completely wrong. The physical work was just work. The real nightmare, the thing that almost derailed his entire project, was the vocabulary.
It's a trap so many people fall into.
He spent weeks just spinning his wheels because he was using the terms electrical panel, switchboard, and switchgear as if they were all just different words for a big metal box with breakers in it.
Which is such a common habit. I mean, in casual conversation, we call everything a panel. You say, oh, go check the panel, or the breaker trips in the main panel.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
We all do. But when you are actually ordering equipment or specifying it for a facility, panel is not a spec. It's just a conversational bucket term. And if you use it wrong on a purchase order, you end up with Dave's embarrassing phone call.
Oh, this part of the story made me cringe so hard. So paint the picture for us here.
Well, Dave calls up a major electrical distributor. He has his chest puffed out. He's ready to spend some serious money on this shop. And he asks for a quote on a main panel for his new service.
Which, to a layperson, seems like a completely reasonable request.
Perfectly reasonable. So the distributor says, sure, no problem, and fires back a quote for a compact panel board. And the price is amazing.
Way under budget.
Way under budget. Dave is thrilled. But then he starts asking these follow-up questions over the phone. He says, hey, can I fit a utility meter inside this thing?
Right.
Can I run three different sub-feeders out the top of it? What is the expandability like if I want to add on later?
And the silence on the other end of that phone line must have been deafening.
It was. The distributor basically had to stop him and say, buddy, you didn't ask for any of that. You asked for a panel. So I gave you a panel. What you actually want is the switchboard.
And there it is. The price jump from a panel board to a switchboard can be pretty significant.
Huge.
But the functionality jump is massive. Dave was basically trying to build a complex industrial system using residential-grade vocabulary.
Precisely. And that is why it matters. Mixing these terms up costs you time, it leads to safety risks, and it results in some very expensive purchasing mistakes.
So that is our mission today. We are going to help you stop shopping for parts and start actually engineering a solution. We need to dismantle this generic term electrical panel and understand the real hierarchy of hardware.
The core trio. Panel boards, switchboards, and switchgear.
Let's start with Dave's solution to his own confusion. He called it the whiteboard breakthrough.
I love this part.
Yeah, he realized he was fixating on all these product names he didn't really understand. So he stepped back and he looked at the project by role, by function.
Which is exactly the engineering approach you should take. You don't start with a catalog. Mm-hmm. You start with the requirements. He wrote three questions on his whiteboard. Where does the power enter? Where is it distributed? And where are the machine controls handled?
And once he did that, the hardware categories actually started to make a lot of sense. So let's walk through them, starting at the bottom, or I guess the most common one, the panel board.
Right. So in the North American standards, this falls under UL 67. Think of the panel board as your downstream distribution. It is designed for branch circuits.
So if you're feeding lights, wall outlets, maybe a small AC unit.
Exactly. You are squarely in panel board territory. Generally speaking, they are wall-mounted, they're relatively shallow, and they are not designed to handle massive amounts of current or really complex utility metering. They are the end of the line for the power.
Okay, but Dave needed more than that. he needed a main. He needed to bring in the big power from the utility, measure it, and then split it off to other places in the shop. And this is where the switchboard comes in.
UL-891.
UL-891.
This is the absolute workhorse of the industry. UL-891 switchboards are what run most commercial buildings and light industrial facilities across North America. The key difference here is physical capacity and flexibility.
Much bigger, right?
Yeah, a switchboard is floor mounted. It's much deeper. It allows you to actually bring in those massive cables from the utility, which we call the service entrance.
And a metering is a huge part of this, too. You can't just easily slap a utility meter on the side of a small wall-mounted panel board.
Not easily, no. And often not legally, depending on your local code. A switchboard is designed from the ground up to have a specific compartment just for the utility company's metering equipment.
That makes sense.
It also allows for feed-through lugs, meaning you can easily daisy chain to another whole section if you need to expand a few years down the line.
And that expansion piece was huge for Dave. He realized that if he bought that cheap panel board, and then 5 years later he wanted to add a new machine shop wing, he would basically have to rip the entire service out and start over.
Whereas with a switchboard, you literally just bolt on another section. It's modular.
Modular is good, but then we get to the category that I think causes the most confusion just because it sounds the coolest. Switchgear.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Switchgear.
UL-1558, the tank. Dave actually admits in his notes that he almost bought this just because he thought industrial automatically meant better.
It's a classic mistake.
He figured, I'm building a serious shop, I should get the serious gear.
A lot of people fall into that exact trap. They think it is just a linear scale of quality. Good, better, best. But switchgear isn't just a better switchboard. It is a fundamentally different machine designed for a very different mission.
Break that down for us. If I'm standing in an electrical room and I'm looking at a UL-891 switchboard and a UL-1558 switchgear lineup, and they're both painted that same industrial gray, what is actually different between them?
If you open the front doors, you would see it immediately. In a switchboard, the devices, the breakers, they're mounted in a group. They might be mounted pretty close together on a common bus. In switchgear, there is intense individual compartmentation. Each breaker is often housed in its own heavy steel cell.
Like a little prison cell for electricity.
In a way, yeah. It is all about containment. If a catastrophic fault happens, a massive short circuit that basically causes an explosion, which we call an arc blast, the switchgear is mechanically designed to keep that explosion contained entirely within that one little cell.
Wow.
So it keeps the rest of the lineup running safely.
So this is really for mission critical stuff. We're talking hospitals, data centers, huge steel mills.
Exactly. Places where you literally cannot afford to turn the power off, or where the raw fault current levels are so high that an uncontained blast would be devastating to the building. But for a workshop? Or even just a standard manufacturing factory? It is massive overkill.
Too much machine for the job.
It's expensive, it is physically huge, and it weighs a ton.
Dave actually compared it to buying an armored tank to commute to the grocery store. Like, sure, you will be incredibly safe, but good luck finding a parking spot, and the gas mileage is going to ruin you.
And don't forget the maintenance. Switchgear often uses these large draw-out breakers that require very specialized regular maintenance. If you do not have a dedicated team of electrical engineers on staff at your facility, do not buy switchgear. Stick to the switchboard.
Okay, so we have the hardware hierarchy sorted out. But then Dave hit another wall on this project. The alphabet soup of testing standards.
The acronyms will get you every time.
It wasn't just about UL numbers anymore. He started seeing terms that looked like they belonged in a history book.
Oh, you're talking about the TTA versus PTTA rabbit hole?
Yes. I seriously felt like I needed a decoder ring just to read this section of the source material. He was looking at some older specs, or maybe it was supplier documents from a European vendor, and he kept seeing type-tested assembly and partially type-tested assembly.
Right.
And he's sitting there trying to figure out which one he's supposed to buy.
This is a perfect example of how legacy terminology just haunts the electrical industry. Those terms, TTA and PTTA, they come from an old standard,
yeah.
IEC 60439. They are effectively obsolete now, but people still use them colloquially in the field all the time.
What did they actually mean back in the day? Why was there even a distinction?
So type-tested meant the manufacturer had physically built that exact specific configuration in a factory, taken it to a testing lab, short-circuited it, cooked it with heat, and literally proved it survived the test.
Okay, that sounds safe.
It was. But partially type-tested meant they physically tested some of the core parts, And then they just use mathematical calculations to guess that the rest of your custom configuration would probably work.
Guess does not sound very reassuring when we were talking about thousands of amps of electricity.
It wasn't reassuring at all. It left a huge gray area for liability if something blew up. That is exactly why the industry moved to the newer standard, IEC 61439. They dropped those old terms entirely. Now, we use the concept of verified assemblies.
What's the practical difference there? Is it just a marketing rebrand?
No, it is a total philosophy shift. It moves from physical destructive testing of every single cabinet to strict design verification. You don't have to blow up every single custom layout. You can use strict verified engineering rules that were derived from the baseline testing.
Oh, okay.
It clarifies exactly who is responsible for the safety, the original manufacturer who made the parts, or the guy assembling it in the local panel shop.
So if Dave is arguing with a vendor about getting a TTA panel in 2026, he is basically arguing about whether to buy a horse or a carriage while everyone else is out there driving cars.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
If a vendor sends you a spec sheet praising their strict TTA compliance, you really need to check the date on that document. It might be 20 years old.
Speaking of confusing labels on these boxes, let's talk about industrial control panels, UL508A. Because this is another area where DIYers, and honestly even a lot of pros, get completely crossed up. Dish made a very specific note in his journal. He wrote, UL508A is for logic, not for the building.
This is so vital to understand. A UL508A panel is strictly for automation and machine control. It is where your PLCs live, your relays, your motor starters, your variable frequency drives. It controls the behavior of the machines. It is not designed to distribute raw power to the building itself.
But I see this happening all the time in smaller shops. Someone builds a massive, beautiful control cabinet for a machine, and they decide, hey, I've got some extra DeLine rail space in here. Let me just throw a 400-amp distribution block in the corner and use it to feed the overhead lights and the shop air compressor.
And that is a severe code violation just waiting to happen.
Yeah.
The safety testing standards are completely different. The heat dissipation rules inside the box are different. You absolutely have to keep your building power, which is your UL891 switchboard, separate from your machine control, your UL508A panel.
Don't mix them.
Do not mix them. It's like trying to run your plumbing pipes through your HVAC air ducts. Just because there's empty physical space in the duct doesn't mean the water pipe belongs there.
That is a great analogy. Now, let's get into this whole commercial versus industrial myth. Because I think we all naturally carry this bias. We assume commercial means office buildings and cheap, floozy stuff. And industrial means heavy-duty, rugged, and expensive.
It's probably one of the most dangerous oversimplifications in the entire field. It is not a sliding scale of quality. It is about the duty cycle.
Meaning just how hard you physically run the equipment.
Exactly. You can easily have a commercial switchboard installed in a modern skyscraper that is built like a Swiss watch. Incredibly high build quality, gold-plated contacts, redundant systems, the works.
Because it has to be reliable.
Right, because if the power goes out in a 50-story financial tower, it is an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
Conversely, you can have industrial equipment in a factory that is actually quite basic and cheaply made, because it is just running a simple conveyor belt in a dry, perfectly climate-controlled warehouse.
So the takeaway for you listening is, don't let the marketing label industrial trick you into vastly overspending your budget.
And don't let the commercial label trick you into underspecing your critical systems. You have to look at your actual fault current levels. Look at how often your operators need to physically operate the breakers. If you are flipping a breaker every single morning to start a production line, you need a very different, much more robust breaker than one that just sits in the on-end position in a basement for 20 years untouched.
Let's pivot to the physical reality of installing this stuff. Because Dave eventually realized that getting the electrical specs right was really only half the battle. He said the architecture decisions were what actually kept him up at night.
Yeah, this is the phase of the project I call, will it fit? And I don't just mean, will the metal box fit through the door of the room, but will it actually function in the room?
Right. He highlights access as the single biggest trap you can fall into. Front versus rear access. Why does this matter so much on a switchboard?
Okay, picture this scenario. You find a beautiful, gently used switchboard on eBay. Great price. You buy it, you get it delivered on a flatbed. You push it right up against the back wall of your electrical room because, hey, it's a really small room and you need the floor space.
Makes sense so far.
But then you realize the main lugs, the bolts you have to turn to connect the giant utility cables, they're located on the back of the bus bar.
Oh, no.
So now, every single time you need to tighten the connection or do a thermal inspection, which you have to do periodically by law, you physically have to unbolt the entire thousands of pounds cabinet from the concrete floor, disconnect the rigid conduit, and drag the whole assembly into the middle of the room.
That's practically impossible. You just wouldn't do the maintenance.
Exactly. You'd skip it.
Yeah.
Which eventually leads to loose connections, which leads to fires. So ensuring you check the box for front access only on your specification sheet is absolutely critical if you're working with a tight electrical room.
And then there's the issue of cable bending radius. I really didn't realize this was such a huge deal until I read Dave's notes. He talks about it like it's an unbreakable law of physics.
Because it is. Heavy gauge copper wire, stuff like 500 MCM or larger, is literally like wrestling a python. It does not want to bend. If your switchboard cabinet is too shallow, or the connection lugs are positioned too close to the side wall of the enclosure, you physically cannot turn the stiff wire to get it inserted into the hole.
It's not about just getting a bigger guy to push harder. It literally just won't fit the geometry.
It won't fit. And if you force it, you end up kinking the wire, which permanently damages the internal insulation and creates a massive hotspot. I have personally seen brand new, very expensive installations completely rejected by the city inspector because the gutter space, the empty space left for the wire to turn, was just 2 inches too narrow.
2 inches, and what do you do then?
You have to tear it out and replace the whole board.
That is an absolute nightmare. Okay, let's talk about safety, because this was the part of Dave's journey that I really came to respect. He started out the project only caring about amps and volts and budgets, but he ended up completely obsessed with NFPA 70E.
Which is the gold standard for electrical safety in the workplace. And frankly, understanding that is more important than the hardware specs themselves.
He talks about shifting his mindset from lowest, quote, wins to lowest operational pain wins. And specifically, he dove deep into arc flash mitigation. What is the modern approach to this? Because I grew up thinking you just put on a thick leather suit, wear a face shield, and hope for the best.
We have thankfully moved way past hope as a safety strategy. Now, it is all about built-in engineering controls. For example, maintenance mode switches. You pay a little bit extra up front for a physical switch on the front panel of the board. When your electrician walks in to do live work, they flip that switch. It immediately tells the main breaker, hey, be super sensitive right now. If you see any spike in current at all, trip instantly.
So it dramatically reduces the amount of energy released if an accident does happen.
Drastically. It can turn a potentially deadly room-clearing explosion into just a startling pop.
Wow. And what about remote operation? You mentioned that too.
That's even better. Why stand in front of the potential bomb at all? For a few $1,000s more on the build sheet, you can specify motor-operated breakers. Your technician can stand 30 feet away, or even in another room, with a tablet or a wired control pendant, press a button, and the breaker opens mechanically. If something goes wrong and it blows up the empty air, not your technician's face.
That seems like an absolute no-brainer for any serious facility upgrade. But let's say you aren't building a massive plant. They listed some really clever alternatives to buying the big iron. One that really stuck out to me was busway distribution. He called it track lighting on steroids.
I love busway systems. It is such an underused solution in smaller shops. Imagine a heavy metal rail running continuously along the ceiling of your shop floor. Inside that rail are solid copper bars carrying 400, 800, maybe even 1,000 amps of power.
And you can just tap into it wherever you want.
Exactly. You buy what's called a bus plug, which is essentially just a breaker inside a small box.
Yeah.
And you physically clamp it onto the overhead rail wherever you happen to need power drop down. If you decide to move your big CNC machine 10 feet to the left next year, you just unclamp the bus plug, slide it over, and reconnect.
You don't have to run all new conduit all the way back to the main electrical room.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
It is brilliant for a workshop or a manufacturing floor that is constantly reconfiguring its layout.
It sounds like it gives you total flexibility.
It does cost a bit more upfront for the rail system, but that flexibility easily pays for itself the very first time you have to rearrange the floor plan.
All right, let's move to the final boss battle of this whole process. You have designed the perfect system. You've picked the right standards. You've double-checked the bending radius. Now you have to actually buy the thing. Dave calls this the procurement reality check.
This is where perfectly good schedules go to die.
He has this chart in his notes called the procurement risk timeline. And his biggest, most painful takeaway is this. The quote phase is not the procurement phase.
So many people don't realize this until it's too late. You get a quote from the vendor that says 12 weeks lead time. You think to yourself, great, I will have the equipment on site in exactly 3 months.
But the clock doesn't actually start when you get that quote.
No, The clock doesn't even start when you cut the purchase order and send the check. The manufacturing clock strictly starts when you approve the submittals.
Explain that process for us. What exactly is a submittal?
You order the switchboard. The factory engineers then take your order, and they literally draw out your specific custom switchboard layout. They send you those detailed engineering drawings, which are the submittals. You then have to review them, check every single physical dimension, verify every breaker size, and formally sign off on the paperwork. Only then do they actually order the raw sheet metal. Only then does your 12-week lead time actually begin.
So if you sit on those drawings on your desk for 2 weeks because you're busy, or if you send them back with a bunch of minor changes,
you just added a month or more to your project timeline. I have personally seen facility projects delayed by 6 solid months just bouncing submittal drawings back and forth at the factory.
And then there's the whole compliance trap. Dave mentions that buying a replacement breaker for your board isn't like buying a replacement toaster for your kitchen. You can't just casually swap brands to save a buck.
This goes right back to the listed assembly issue we talked about earlier. If you buy a Square D panel board, you generally must use Square D manufactured breakers inside it. If you happen to find a compatible Siemens breaker on eBay for half the price, you cannot just jam it in there.
Even if it physically snaps onto the rail perfectly?
Even if it fits perfectly. Doing that instantly voids the UL safety listing of the entire assembly.
So if the city electrical inspector walks in and sees that mismatched breaker,
he fails your inspection on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And now you are frantically trying to source the correct brand name breaker on a Friday afternoon while your entire plant is sitting there dead in the water.
Which brings us neatly to the topic of spare parts. Dave's approach here was refreshingly practical. He didn't just say, buy two of absolutely everything. He focused strictly on what he called downtime reducers.
Which is very smart. You do not need to keep a spare metal enclosure door in your closet. You very rarely need a spare copper buzz bar. But you absolutely 100% need to stock spare control fuses.
And pilot lights. He had that high on his list, which seemed a bit trivial to me at first glance.
Oh, it is not trivial at all. Think about it. If the little green running light burns out on the front panel, a machine operator might walk up and think the entire machine is dead. They call maintenance. You spend an hour pulling out meters and troubleshooting a complex machine that is actually working perfectly fine, all because of a burned out $5 light bulb.
Okay, that makes total sense. But the one spare part Dave listed as the absolute most ignored wasn't even a piece of hardware, it was paper.
The printed is built drawings.
Like physical paper. In 2026, we are still printing things out and keeping them in the room.
Think about the context. When do you most desperately need to look at your electrical drawings?
Well, when the power is completely out.
Exactly. When the main power is out, your local server is down. The shop Wi-Fi is down. Your desktop PC in the office is dead. If your critical schematics are only stored on the cloud, you are flying completely blind during an emergency.
So the old school method of keeping the laminated schematic sheets tucked in the little pocket inside the enclosure door is still the gold standard.
It is the absolute gold standard. It saves hours and hours of frantic troubleshooting time. You look at a wire and say, where does wire 402 go? If you can just look at the inside of the door and see, oh, it runs to the emergency stop button, you're done. You found the problem. If you have to guess, you are looking at a very, very long night.
We have one final hurdle to cover before we wrap this up. Local codes. Dealing with the AHJ, the authority having jurisdiction.
The final boss of every electrical project.
Dave is very quick to point out that the National Electrical Code, the NEC, is really just a framework until your local city adopts it. But the local utility company's rules, those are absolute law.
And utility companies are weirdly specific about how they want things done. We call it the golden rule in the trade. He who has the gold, or in this case the power, makes the rules.
Dave specifically warned about utility metering requirements.
Yes. This trips up so many people. Some utilities absolutely require what's called cold sequence metering, meaning the main disconnect switch comes first and then the meter. Other utilities in the next county over want hot sequence metering, where the power hits the meter before the disconnect. Some want the meter outside the building, some want it inside the main electrical room.
So if you order a $20,000 switchboard and the factory configured the meter compartment for hot sequence, but your specific local utility strictly demands cold sequence,
you are standing there holding a $20,000 steel boat anchor.
Ouch!
Pretty much. You either have to pay a ton of money to modify it in the field, which is dangerous and difficult, or you have to crate it back up and send it back to the factory. Always get the utility company's specific spec sheet before you sign off on those switchboard submittal drawings.
It really sounds like the overarching theme of Dave's whole journey is this. Ask the hard questions first and buy the heavy metal second.
That's it, exactly. You have to move your brain from a consumer mindset where you're saying, I'm just buying a product out of a catalog, to an engineering systems mindset where you say, I am designing a complete safe solution for this facility.
So let's recap the really big takeaways from this deep dive for anyone out there staring down the barrel of a facility upgrade.
Number one, vocabulary matters immensely. Do not use the word panel if you actually mean switchboard. You need to intimately know the functional difference between UL67, UL891, and UL5-turn58. Verify the physical fit before you buy. Front versus rear access. Cable bending radius and gutter space. Do not buy a beautiful metal box that your electricians physically cannot wire up.
Number three.
Prioritize safety over initial savings. Look for arc flash reduction features like maintenance mode switches. And absolutely ensure you are not dangerously mixing your machine controls, your UL508A stuff, inside the same box as your building power distribution.
And finally,
respect the procurement timeline. The initial quote is just the starting line. You have to actively manage the engineering submittals and always double-check the metering rules with your local utility company before you commit the funds.
I think Dave put it best right at the end of his journal. He said, the best electrical assembly isn't the one with the flashiest marketing brochure. It is the one that perfectly matches the actual job role, the local code path, and the reality of how it will be maintained.
A very painful lesson for him to learn, but an incredibly valuable one for us to read.
So here's a final thought to leave you with today. Next time you walk past that big gray metal box in your basement, or you walk past the main electrical room at your office, just take a second to really look at it. Don't just look at the brand name sticker on the front. Ask yourself, is this a robust system that was intentionally designed for safe maintenance and future expansion? Or is it just a cramped box that was designed to fit the absolute bare minimum budget the day it was bolted to the floor?
Because if it's just a budget box, it might just be waiting to become your next major headache.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. Stay grounded, and we will catch you on the next one.
Stay safe out there.